So the other day, something terrible happened. I mean, it's something we all have to go through at least once in our lives. Yep. I ran out of coffee. So I did what I think most of us do. We walk down to our local cafes, some of us maybe even run, and we look for some roasted coffee to take home. And on the walls, we see these beautifully packaged bags of roasted coffee. This one's crimson red, that one's pastel blue. There's so many of them, I often don't even know what to choose.
Hey.
Andrea.
Nice to meet you, James.
Nice to meet you too.
So I often ask the barista for their favorites.
Looking to buy a coffee?
Okay.
Something for filter?
Mm-hmm.
What's good?
Well, my favorite at the moment is this one, La Cancha. From El Salvador.
Cool. Let's go El Salvador. Why not?
El Salvador.
What will that set me back?
Then you pay for it.
Yes,
okay. Cheers.
Ciao.
You take it home. Pour the beans into the grinder. Grind it. Get your hot water. Brew it. Pour it into your cup. And finally, you sit down, and you can enjoy it.
Let's see. Flavor notes: sweet chocolate, molasses, hibiscus, plums and berries, creamy body. Let's see whether I get any of those. Oh wow, molasses. Plums, berries. Yeah, it's like a Christmas pudding. That's really good.
And then you might get your phone out, open the news, and then you see this.
Build that wall. Build that wall. Build that wall!
Now, us buying that coffee from El Salvador and Trump talking about a border wall, totally unrelated. Or are they? Over the next 5 episodes, I'm going to show how your decision to buy a Salvadoran coffee is connected to the border wall. And it's going to be a big story, because it's a story of El Salvador, their country. A country of 6 million people in this rectangular box, about the size of Israel or New Jersey. It's a story of power, massacres, wide inequality, and how it threads with your family history. Well, insofar as what coffees your parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents drank. And it's also a story about how our actions today affect the border wall. And at the end of it all, we're going to get back to that cafe and look at those bags of coffee one more time. Should we still choose a Salvadoran coffee? I think so, but it depends who it's from. And not just from El Salvador, but across the world. I'm James Harper, and this is Filter Stories, the untold stories hidden in your cup of coffee. In this first episode, I'm going to present 2 stories about the origins of coffee in El Salvador. We're looking at 1850s to the 1930s. The facts are the same, but the stories are very different. So picture your great-grandmother sitting down and enjoying a cup of coffee. Imagine she was curious to know where her coffee came from and maybe who in El Salvador grew it. This first story will be most likely the story your great-grandmother would have been told.
Hello? Hello, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm at El Molino.
Yes.
There you are. Okay, great. All right. Thank you very much, guys.
So I'm in the west of El Salvador in a car being dropped off at a colonial era hacienda. Think wooden columns, tiled roofs.
Hey, well, how are you?
I'm here to meet this man.
Nice to meet you.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Mauricio.
Face to face.
His name is Mauricio Escalon.
Until next time.
Yes. Thank you for everything.
I haul my bags out of the car and Mauricio leads me into one of the rooms that all face the courtyard.
Here is the is our office. Yeah, okay. This used to be the old mill. Yeah, let's say the volume mill.
In the middle of this room hangs this big oil painting
by Pedro José. Yeah, he was.
So this is a picture of a man sporting a 19th century mustache.
Yes.
Very large white mustache, and a lot of fabric, a lot of ties and fabric. Was he your great-great-great-granddad?
Yes, yes, he was my great-great-great-great-grandfather. I'm the fifth generation, yeah? And
You guys look identical.
Huh? Really?
Yeah, I think he's identical.
So, let's turn back the hands of time, like way back to 1850s El Salvador. In the 1850s, El Salvador is all about agriculture. It makes a lot of its money growing and exporting indigo, a plant that's used to make blue dye for fabrics. And El Salvador back then is idyllic.
The environs of the city are very beautiful, being one mass of luxuriant orange and mango trees, bending beneath their load of fruit.
I found the memoirs of the wife of the British ambassador in the 1850s, and this is how she described the capital, San Salvador.
And the cottages of the poor people are remarkably neat and clean, each surrounded by its own beautiful shrubbery of fruit trees.
Now, Pedro José, Mauricio's great-great-great-great-grandfather, owns a fair amount of land. But he and the other wealthier landowners have a problem. Synthetic blue dye has been invented. The indigo plant's days are numbered. But fortunately, coffee has arrived on the scene. And in the 1860s, Mr. Pedro José gets in on the action.
And in 1865, he started to do some of the pulping experiments about coffee and everything.
And Pedro José is quite the jet setter by 1860s standards.
Francisco, because he lived a lot of time in San Francisco, yeah? 6 months in San Francisco, 6 months here.
Mr. Pedro José knows the way to make money in coffee is to export it. And fortunately, he's in the right place to find a buyer.
And he had very good connections with people in San Francisco. So they started with this Folger family, yeah, to talk about the export of coffee. So we can say they did the first exports from El Salvador to the United States, yeah.
To Folgers, no less.
Yeah, Folgers companies is still in the market, yeah.
But this is huge. I mean, this goes back to like the... Folgers is one of the largest roasters in America.
Yes, yes, yes. That is how he started. Yeah, having the confidence with this Folger, Mr. Folger.
So coffee exports start growing fast, and El Salvador's politicians want to change the image of their country. They want capitalists to take a risk and help the country build roads, a banking sector, industry, and one thing El Salvador has is fantastic agricultural land.
Like the government at that time started to give land to people to start growing coffee, yeah?
El Salvador had all this land that wasn't being used productively.
It started to grow coffee, yeah, because there was nothing at that time.
And this is great news for the peasants of El Salvador.
And they have something that is, I will say, that is much better than probably food and clothes. They have work, yeah?
There's so much money to be made. Lots of different people get in on the action.
And then a lot of companies, people started to do the same, yeah? And there were like very big, big companies, yeah?
But then these capitalists encounter a new problem. Communism arrives in the 1920s. The peasants are lapping it up and they try and start a revolution.
And... In 1932, there was a revolution, and Izalco is one of the emblematic cities in El Salvador because we say that communism was stopped there. And I can say, because my grandfather from my mom's side was a military in that time, so we had a history about that also.
After the government takes back control, the country continues to prosper economically, and the capitalists who took the risk in the first place start amassing a lot of wealth.
Wow, I mean, this is what. Can we just pause for a second and look at where we are? Where it's like this is like old world luxury.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, this house is from 1760. Yeah,
and you can feel this wealth just standing in the courtyard of Mauricio's hacienda.
And here we have an animal. It was some antlers mounted on the wall. Yeah. What animal is that?
¿Qué animal es este? ¿Qué animal será? ¿Qué cacho de qué animal? He's my dad.
Oh, hola.
Like a deer.
Deer, okay.
Mauricio's dad starts up the engine of the vintage Mini Cooper sitting in the driveway. This is the only vintage car I've ever seen in Central America during my travels.
We love English cars, yeah?
If our great-grandmother asked where her coffees came from in El Salvador, she might have been told that the coffee was a product of the hard work from these capitalist pioneers like Pedro José. He is opening El Salvador to the world, bringing the country into the modern age. And if he makes money while doing it, well, that's his reward.
I am not ashamed of what we have done. A lot of people in the world, I will say, if I have a Rolex, if I have a Land Rover, if I have a Mini Cooper, it's because we have worked for that, yeah? And we like to do it, yeah? And we are proud.
Mauricio's dad steps on the gas and takes a Mini Cooper for an evening spin. Okay, so that was the first story. Now, let's rewind the hands of time again and get back to 1850s El Salvador. To understand the second story, we need to know more about who lived in El Salvador back in the 1850s. And lucky for us, the wife of the British ambassador wrote a lot about that. She mentions the wealthy classes like Mauricio's great-great-great-great-grandfather, Pedro José. She also talks about indigenous Salvadorans.
Many of the most fertile lands in the country belong to the Indian communities.
These indigenous Salvadorans farm a lot of this fertile ancestral land communally. The third and final group she mentions are the mestizos. They are the half-bloods, a mixture of European peasants who left Europe in search of a better life, and they mingled with indigenous Salvadorans. And her most important observation of all is that El Salvador is relatively equal.
What most strikes one on arriving from Europe is the absence of all extreme poverty. The eye is not offended, as it is in the south of Europe, by swarms of loathsome objects afflicted with every disease under the sun. Nor do you see the gaunt forms and starving faces that meet you too often in every town in England.
Palestine.
Yep.
Ugh. Let's do it.
Okay.
So how does this all change once coffee arrives on the scene? To answer that question, we're meeting this man.
Okay, yeah. My name is Álvaro Castro, and I'm an economist. I have always worked in banks and, you know, been part of the, just been a little cog in the big capitalist machine.
He also knows a thing or two about coffee.
I'm also the son of a coffee grower.
Álvaro and I have just pulled up outside a private members club. We're up on this mountain, the city spreading out below us. Álvaro leads me down these hallways of this private members club, and we end up in a conference room.
Which is like the workup.
The TV is blaring professional wrestling.
It's all staged.
I know.
It's not real.
I know. But it's a special of this building.
Álvaro loves this stuff.
You have to watch like one full show, and then you'll see the light. It's like...
Thank God I have a microphone in my hand, so I tell him to turn it off.
Let's just wait for the waiter to turn it off.
All right.
Okay, there we go.
We sit down and get into the story. So, El Salvador, 1850s. Not too equal, but not too unequal either. And there's not very much coffee in the country. And then things change.
So what happened, and peasants, you know, natives, they had communal lands that they grew their food on, and it was all managed in a communal way. So it would. So the government, what they did is that they found out that in order to boost the development of the country, they decided to take all this communal land from the indigenous people, and they gave it to the upper classes, who had the capital to work it.
So, A small group of wealthy land-owning families begin to plant lots and lots of coffee. And coffee explodes! In the 1860s, coffee is just 2% of El Salvador's exports. But by 1926, it's 95%. Meanwhile, the government passes vagrancy laws in 1881. It's now compulsory for Salvadorans to work wherever they can find work. And indigenous Salvadorans, who are quickly losing their communal land, are being driven to work on the growing coffee plantations, owned by a few wealthy families. I asked Salvador, what would it have been like working on one of these coffee plantations?
So can you imagine you being a peasant? You cannot read and write. You have 7 children. They don't go to school. They're just waiting for them to be, 12 years old to work full-time on the farm. And if you're of indigenous origin, the more indigenous you were, the more rejected you were. You were closer to an animal.
Add to this, food shortages. El Salvador's population is growing quickly. Between the 1850s to 1930s, in about 70 years, the population more than triples. And El Salvador has super fertile volcanic soil. But so much is being used to grow coffee, the country begins importing food. Food prices rise. And by the 1920s, peasant workers are going hungry. The Communist Political Party hijacks this frustration and helps persuade peasant workers to strike. And in 1932, it all comes to a head. Thousands of peasants, mostly indigenous Salvadorans, attack plantations in the West. They fight with mostly what they have to hand, machetes. And the estimates suggest they murder between 20 to 50 people. And unfortunately for these peasants, months before this attack, El Salvador's democratic government is overthrown by the military. To learn how this military government responds, I traveled to Izalco, one of the beating hearts of this rebellion.
James.
I meet the town's archivist, Mauricio.
My name is Mauricio Benjamin Bautista Arucha.
Yeah, the burial site, yeah.
We walk through the town square into this quiet park, and at the end of it lies this memorial to El Salvador's bloodiest massacre.
We have a large, maybe it's a 2-3 meter high kind of mound of rocks and a small plaque.
A local schoolgirl accompanying the archivist reads out the plaque.
En conmemoración de los sucesos de 1932 y de sus víctimas que nuestra memoria se niega a olvidar.
Military government forces swept the region, taking back control from the indigenous peasants. They then began their revenge.
Can you please describe how they were killed?
Podemos ver que aquí,
Mauricio, the archivist, points to the ground.
La concentración de las personas se iban a sacar de las casas.
Here, indigenous peasants were rounded up, then given shovels and picks, and they dug a deep hole.
Una vez terminada la fosa, pues los ejecutaban.
Then they were shot.
En la parte del pueblo de Dolores.
And then, in the town of Dolores, nearly 3,000 indigenous peasants were led to believe that they would be safe from the killings at the local church. In front of the atrium, the military hid a machine gun. They unveiled it, then opened fire. The body count included the elderly and children.
And what was the result?
From Mauricio's point of view, this was an extermination. Estimates of the dead range from 10 to 40,000 people. Most of them murdered in the first 72 hours. Here is Alvaro, the economist again.
And after the slaughter of 1932, a lot of people just, well, they changed their indigenous names to more to Spanish-sounding last names in order not to be persecuted. They stopped talking their dialects, Nahuatl being the major one.
Where can you find indigenous culture in El Salvador today?
Ha! In a museum, in a book. You can still see some elderly people that survived that massacre and that kept the language and some customs, but it's just a tiny little pebble.
In a later episode, we'll connect how indigenous Salvadorans losing a connection to their land and culture can be tied to Trump's border wall. Now, what does all of this have to do with coffee? To me, it seems like this unequal society that led to the massacre was fueled by coffee profits. These profits went into the hands of a minority of wealthy families. It didn't go to help peasant Salvadorans to progress upwards economically. I throw this theory to our economist, Alvaro.
And is it a stretch to say, you know, the slaughter happened because of coffee?
You know, when you contacted me, you mentioned something like that. And I had never seen it that way. But it got me thinking, coffee was a big driver. It was not the only one, but it was the main pillar of the economy. So you cannot take it out of the equation. So yes, a lot of people were murdered because of a cup of coffee. You can put it that way.
We've just heard two very different stories about the history of coffee in El Salvador. However you want to see this story, capitalism against communism, a small number of Caucasian families exploiting indigenous people and land. The fact is, from the 1930s onwards, coffee profits continue to flow into the hands of a small number of wealthy families.
And coffee at this point is growing as an industry?
Yes. Coffee is the grano de oro. Okay.
This is Alvaro, our economist again. No, just translate that for my listeners.
Grano de oro, it's just the golden bean.
Like the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Yeah, pretty much. So
the 50s to the 70s are a golden period for these wealthy families. The profits from coffee help these families get into other sectors of the Salvadoran economy. The military government keeps the status quo, and poorer Salvadorans struggle to progress upwards economically.
The privileged families. Institutions were created in order to boost economic development and industry, but all its rewards, they always went to the wealthy ones, and some of the crumbs were given here and there. And then you have this huge mass of people that were oppressed in the sense of lacking opportunities to progress.
Your coffee's delicious. Do you know something I don't know?
It's Folger's flaked coffee, flaked to release lots of rich flavor.
By the 1970s, the tiny little country of El Salvador is the fourth largest coffee producer in the world.
Delicious coffee, Mrs. Olson.
Oh, thanks. It's Folger's flaked coffee.
Now, here's the thought. When your parents and grandparents enjoy their morning coffees, they unknowingly sent their money into El Salvador's unequal economic system.
You only need four of Folger's flaked coffee.
And who would have thought that their coffee dollars would help create one of the bloodiest civil wars in the 20th century.
Delicious.
Do you know something I don't know?
Delicious Folger's flaked coffee. Flaked to release Folger's rich flavor in automatic drip coffee makers.
Our economist Alvaro has a nickname for his own country.
This country, I told before that I call it El Savage. It sounds funny, but it's a savage country when you have so much inequality.
In the next episode, we'll explore how this inequality killed 75,000 people in the 1980s, and how that set the stage for a giant wave of migration into the USA. Thank you for listening. Every week, I'm going to release a new part to this series. There's 5 in total. Now, the other 4 are very close to being finished. And for everybody who participated in the Indiegogo campaign, which is still open, I'm going to send a link with the other 4 episodes as soon as they're ready. So if you want to hear the rest of the series sooner rather than later, join the Filter Stories Indiegogo campaign. Maria's coffee could make a great Christmas present. There's a link to the campaign in the episode description. Also, a quick word before I go, if you really like what you heard, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is one of the best and one of the very few ways for independent podcasters like me to get the word out. So if you like what you heard, tell a friend. This episode was sound mixed by Dom Edgley. You can find more of his work at domedgleysound.com. And Filter Stories logo was created by Headquarters, a packaging and branding design team. Find more of their work at headquarters.studio. Thanks so much. Speak to you next time.